Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. For candidates running for the People's Party of Canada, the CBC news story published yesterday surely drew a reaction from both supporters and detractors. A People's Party of Canada candidate in Saskatoon is coming under fire for sharing a cartoon photo on Twitter that depicts NDP leader Jagmeet Singh wearing a turban with a bomb on it. The candidate said he did not realize it was a bomb, saying it appeared like a toque. However, the executive director for the Canadian Anti-Hate Network said the cartoon is racist. The network is monitoring all candidates from all parties during the federal election. Well, today's guest will hopefully shine some light on this and other issues related to the People's Party of Canada. In studio with me to discuss his campaign and his party's platform is Frank Vaughan. Welcome, Frank.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking about the statement related to the racism and white supremacy. There have been numerous stories tagging candidates and your leader as being racist or white supremacist. How do you respond to the stories like the one on CBC yesterday and others?
They're very easily disproven. And the way that you can do that is you can go to the peoplespartyofcanada.ca and look at our candidates. It's very simple. You go to the website, you click on candidates. The other thing that is seldom ever reported about our party is not only the minority candidates that we have, but the racism that we actually come under. We had an event in Hamilton last Sunday. We were hosting a gay Jewish man. The keynote speaker was a Muslim immigrant who is running in London Center. And out front, we had people coming into the event from every ethnic background, and we had 100 people punching us in the face, calling us Nazis, screaming at us, and trying to stab our eyes out. And it's a shameful thing, and we don't get the coverage about this side of it. We face hate everywhere we go. Now, this is news to me. I've been busy doing debates. This could have been an exercise in bad judgment, bad character. I have no idea. I'd like to know the more of the details. But the fact of the matter is, Anti-Hate Network is an interesting organization because they actually have a campaign where you can sign up to end white people. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but racism cuts both ways. If you have a campaign that is targeting an ethnic group, meaning white people, and what does that even mean? How can you really call yourself an anti-hate group? It's ridiculous.
But this incident yesterday is not isolated. I mean, in the Essex riding last week, the candidate there was apologizing for making racist and transphobic comments. He did not deny making them on social media and said he was sorry. If you are not a party that supports racism or other forms of discrimination, why not just say, you don't get to run with our party and be done with it and find another suitable candidate?
Well, if it's actually an incident of legitimate racism, that's exactly what we do. I don't know how many times we can come out and condemn that sort of thing, and I don't know how many times we can issue statements saying that white nationalists and this sort of stuff is not welcome in our party. That being said, why would so many people in our party, so many of our candidates who are from African background, Jewish backgrounds, Arab backgrounds, we have Muslims, we have Christians, we have atheists. Why is it that the fixation is on the exceptions to the rule? Why aren't the media in this country interviewing our people of ethnic minority origin? They're completely ignored. CBC, for instance, they reached out and they asked us for a list of our LGBT candidates. And we said we don't have a list because we don't ask people what their sexual orientation is when they come into our party. But we had some of our LGBT candidates reach out to CBC, and CBC never got back to them because these cases are meant to smear us. But if the media wants to do something fair, they should reach out to our candidates of minority. If you're not going to ask our minority candidates and our minority members why they're in our party, you're tokenizing them. And that's another issue. these articles and this media coverage seems to be saying that these candidates of ours that are from minority groups are tokens, and that is overtly racist. So let's have a discussion both ways.
Do you think the blackface incident involving Liberal leader Justin Trudeau is a sign he is a racist?
No, I don't. I think it's a sign that he is the biggest hypocrite to ever occupy the Prime Minister's office. I think it shows incredible bad taste. But I won't go as far as to say he's racist, because times have changed. He exercised bad judgment. He dressed up for Halloween. He dressed up in blackface. And you can argue about whether or not he should have done that. But I don't think, in all seriousness, that you can make a case that Justin Trudeau is racist. And for those who are calling him racist because of this, you're jumping on the political correctness bandwagon. And we're not going to play that game, because in Canada, we have lost our sense of humor. I made an anecdote the other night. We were talking about the West, and I'm trying to bring the real issue to the East of a growing Western separatist movement that we have to deal with, and it's going to be the East that keeps this country together. And I made an anecdote because one of the candidates was talking about how basically they don't want jobs in oil out there. They want sustainable energy jobs and this and that and the other thing. And I said, if you took that message to the West, you and you gave it at a town hall, you might not leave the town hall in pure physical safety. And they said I was being physically aggressive and I was threatening and all this stuff. It was an anecdote to highlight the Western anger. We've lost our ability to have anecdotal conversations, and we're so hypersensitive that I fear we're weakening society. So I won't jump on that bandwagon, but I will say Trudeau is the biggest hypocrite in the history of Canada.
Do you hold any views or have done anything that someone might accuse you of being racist?
I don't believe so.
Okay. Is there any of this that has had an impact on the doorsteps when you've been out there campaigning?
No, not really. This is actually, I'll be honest with you, and I appreciate the question, because I've been looking forward to answering these criticisms, but nobody's asked me about them. This just does not seem to be a concern in Northumberland, Peterborough South. I think what it is I'm known in the community for my other work as a garlic farmer. I have customers from all different backgrounds, so it's very hard to label me as a racist or a bigot, and it's also hard for people who know me to think that I would willingly engage with a party that was racist or bigoted. And again, I just have to point to our candidates and our members and some of the people who speak on our behalf. There's a channel on YouTube, and I'm not trying to promote somebody, but her name is Elle, and she's a transgender woman, and she's one of the biggest supporters of our party. So, I mean, we have people from all over the place, but the media is not telling that story, and I welcome the opportunity to be able to tell that story from you.
What are people saying to you then when you are on the doorstep? I noticed the other day on your Twitter feed that you had a little incident at a coffee shop after a debate where you met a young woman when you were getting coffee and she talked to you. Could you maybe share that story with us?
Yeah, so one of the things I'm always surprised by, and it's kind of funny because we're labeled by the media as a party of old white men and old white ladies, but the fact of the matter is we're not. And the thing that always amazes me is the youth that I talk to that are engaging with us. And this young lady is just a hardworking lady in a coffee shop. And as I'm getting my coffee, she said, "Can you please tell me your name?" And I said, "It's Frank Vaughn." And she's like, "Oh my God, I watch your video work and I'm familiar with what you're doing. And, you know, keep it up. We need more free speech in this country." But there are a lot of young people that are concerned with the cloak of political correctness. And the other thing too is there's a lot of, and that's one of the attractions to our party from a lot of immigrants, is that we are dedicated to free speech and freedom of expression. Many of our people escaped from countries that are very oppressive, and they don't understand why we are self-censoring when censorship is an issue that's enforced at the barrel of a gun where they came from. But we self-enforce. We put ourselves in a prison without bars where we don't express ourselves, and that's important to a lot of people.
Okay, then what are people saying to you when you're going and knocking on the doors?
It's a positive reception overall. Like, I haven't had much negativity. Now, I don't know. I'm a big guy. I'm 6'5". I don't know if people are afraid to express negative opinions to me. But even if they're not supporting, they're open to listening. And that's kind of what I found. And the other thing, too, is I'm routinely surprised, because one of the other narratives that's always sort of spun about the party is that we're vote splitting and we're taking all our support from the CPC. But I have a lot of Trudeau voters that are coming over to the PPC because they're looking for something new, something different, something more representative of their views. And even in my own particular case, my financial agent for my campaign is a former Green. The secretary of my EDA is a former NDP. The vice president of my EDA is a conservative and libertarian. He's been back and forth. So, I mean, we're drawing attention from a lot of sources. It's not just ex-conservatives.
It's interesting you mention that, because one of the things that I was going to ask you to do is put yourself on the political spectrum, because oftentimes you're described as being far right. How would you describe where you sit on the political spectrum?
Well, first off, far right is a cop-out. That's what anybody who brings a counterpoint to the table seems to be labeled far right these days. For instance, Dave Rubin, the guy that came down to Hamilton, he's a classical liberal, but he got labeled in the Hamilton Spectator as a far right Nazi enabler. And it's the most ridiculous thing. He's Jewish and he's gay. I don't understand it. Where I would put us is common sense. I don't like the right-left dichotomy, because we have a lot of socially liberal positions. We have some positions that are looking to reform things. We have libertine or libertarian positions, which is more in line with classical liberalism. We want to enable people to have more of their own money and live in freedom and be able to express themselves. So I think we have policies that would be traditionally on the left and traditionally on the right, but I feel the mainstream of politics is just moving leftwards. So anything right of center is considered far right these days.
Could you give me some examples of some socially liberal policies that your party holds?
Well, we don't care who you sleep with. We don't care what goes on in your bedroom. Well, we're open to all ideas. We're not trying to put anybody back in the closet, and we actually are advocates of true equality. We don't ask or care about what race you are. We don't ask you questions, because we're constantly being fed this intersectionality of gender and race, where you're basically being assessed some sort of point system that nobody understands based on your DNA and where you were born. We just see everybody equally. We don't see your origin or your sexual orientation, and that is a classic liberal position. It's the actual flowering of true equality.
Okay, so that's one specific thing. Can you give me something else that we might recognize as a policy that would be a socially liberal policy? And I'm saying liberal as small l.
Right. So dedication to free speech and free expression and freedom of religion. We stand against bills like C-16 and M-103, which seek to criminalize speech. We also stand against Article 13 being put back in the Human Rights Act, which would basically allow politicians to criminalize different forms of speech depending on the politics of the day. These are very liberal positions.
Now, freedom of speech, though, let's just take a moment and talk about that, because freedom of speech, we do have restrictions on freedom of speech. For example, you and I right now on the radio, we can't commit libel or slander because, you know, we can't go out and destroy somebody's reputation by simply publicizing something that's factually incorrect. How is that not different from asking people to say, okay, besides not being able to ruin someone's reputation by saying terrible things about them, we're not going to let you say hateful things about somebody or those kinds of things?
Well, we are entering into territory now where the left has lost its way from liberalism so much that we're not just talking about hate speech anymore. We're saying that if somebody comes along and says they want to be called Zer instead of he or she, or they want to be called by some sort of formal title, that you can be hauled into court and sued over that. That's a problem. Mutual respect is something that's bestowed. It's not something that you can criminalize or demand. And there are people in this country who have literally had their lives ruined because they just failed to use the proper pronoun. So we stand against that.
Okay. So that's one example. But I guess what I'm saying is that at the same time, what should give you the right to come along and say hateful things about me or things about me that are hateful? In other words, is that not something that falls within the same range as saying something's not libelous? I mean, you're talking about specifics going to court and being sued, but at the same time, shouldn't there be laws that say I can't get on the radio and just say a whole bunch of stereotypical things that are demeaning and undermine a particular person over their race or over their sexual identity or over their gender?
Well, we already have laws, as you've mentioned, against libel, and we have laws against slander. But we also have to foster a spirit of debate and criticism, and that sometimes means that uncomfortable things have to get discussed. That is the foundation stone of democracy, is having uncomfortable discussions. And what we're talking about now is passing laws and regulations that will, instead of looking to protect people from physical harm or protect people from legitimate hate speech, we are entering into territory where we want to protect people from having their feelings hurt. Nobody cares about my feelings being hurt when it comes to what happened in Hamilton, where we're literally called bigots and racists, regardless of who we come. Nobody wants to protect me. So we're looking at creating one-sided laws to protect people from having their feelings hurt, and I reject that.
Okay. Let's move on and talk about another important issue platform that your party has in regards to the environment. So let's start with the carbon tax. What's the People Party of Canada's position on the carbon tax?
Simply put, we want to get rid of a carbon tax, and the Conservatives want to get rid of the carbon tax and replace it with a carbon price. We don't want sleight of hand. We want to get rid of the carbon tax, and we want to repudiate the Paris Climate Treaty. We want to pull out of it because, in essence, humans cannot control climate, and we don't control climate right now. Now, I know what's going to come up is the so-called consensus, and I've got documents here that I take to every debate with me that I try to get people to look at. I have one petition here from 90 scientists, and contrary to popular belief, they're publicly funded. They are not funded by oil wealth. They're just from one country, Italy. There's another body of 500 other climate scientists. They will release their findings on October 18th in Oslo, and they can't get a hearing at the IPCC.
Okay, so I'll come back to that in a second, but let's just stay focused on our carbon tax for just a second. So what are we going to do then? We look around us, glaciers are melting, things are happening, you know, there's got to be something done. What are you going to offer as an alternative? What's a better system than this one?
Well, number one is you can't do anything about glacial melt. We don't have that control. We are in an interglacial warm period. Ask any geologist about it. And because you're alive today and you're living in the Northern Hemisphere, you need to thank your interglacial warm period. We have had ice retreat for 11,000 years. And all of a sudden, humans are said to be responsible for that. And they're said to be responsible based on a pile of bad data. I have a graph here. I wish I could show you. But it's every model prediction from the 1980s. And it shows how massively they failed. There's also many predictions that I've got my hand on right now about ice-free Arctic by 2000, ice-free Arctic by 2008, by 2013, by 2018. The Arctic's not ice-free. And some of these glaciers are growing, and that's the other thing. The media's not doing a good job of conveying both sides of the story. They talk about the consensus. John Cook's consensus, that's the paper that came up with the 97% number, was arrived at by doing a keyword search of global warming and man-made climate change, and he came up with his 12,000 papers. But when we did it, and then there was a peer-reviewed rebuttal, it found that only 40 of those papers explicitly supported the argument of man-made climate change. So again, nobody's telling you that story, and it would be easy for me, very easy for me, to come on this show and go to these debates and just agree. That's what all the other parties are doing. But there's another side to the story, and it's scientifically backed. There's thousands of peer-reviewed studies that refute the climate emergency.
All right, so you've got your studies, and the other side has their studies. And so I'm sitting at home and I'm saying to myself, wait a minute. In my daily life, I see massive forest fires, unprecedented numbers. I see major storms, unprecedented in our history. We've mentioned the melting glaciers. Well, heck, Tuesday, I was on campus and students are walking around wearing shorts. And then tonight I hear the weather report and it's going below zero over a period of 2 days. It seems like the evidence is right before our eyes. So how then do I make a good decision about my future? Because if you're wrong, we all die. If I'm wrong, we're still going to be here. So with those stakes, how can you argue what you argue?
Because what you're talking about is completely false. Forest fires are not unprecedented. Okay. I have the statistics.
No, I'm not disagreeing with that. And I'll stand that you have studies and you have the stats.
I have the data.
Right. But when you think about this, and then when we talk about the stakes, if you're wrong, we're all dead. If I'm wrong, guess what? we're all still living.
For 40 years, they've been saying we were going to be dead. In 10 years, 20 years, we're not dead. The climate's dynamic. It's never been stable. And when you are literally creating a psychological situation where people are living in fear, and when the schools are indoctrinating the students into this science, and they're not giving both sides, and they're creating a climate of fear, of absolute hysteria, that is an issue. People have, like, I heard so many people at these debates saying, I don't want to have kids because I'm afraid the world's going to end. That is completely irresponsible. The world's not going to end. And this idea that these times that we live in are without precedent, that's because people don't have a relationship with nature and the land. It's not without precedent. We've always had storms. We've always had fires. We've always had floods. And a lot of the flooding that you see, that's another incident that's important to the people of Northumberland, Peterborough South, is the flooding along Lake Ontario. It's the decision of the International Joint Commission to regulate the flow of water out of Lake Ontario. That's a man-made disaster, but it's not created by climate change, and it's also the result of things like tile draining the land. We have an environmental policy. It's based on clean water, wilderness preservation, wildlife preservation, getting rid of heavy metals, and actually looking at things that we can do to improve the environment. Regulating carbon is nothing but a way to regulate every living form of life in perpetuity by the government. And I've asked people this in the debates.
So how do we get to a point, though, Frank, where we're actually having a debate? Because you're energized right now. I've talked to other candidates who get energized on the other side of this debate. And as somebody who's sitting at home listening to this, I'm starting to put my hands up in the air and going, what the hell am I supposed to believe? Here's all these scientists that are telling me international joint commissions and all these kinds of experts. And then you're saying you got experts. How do we negotiate this so that we can go forward in good conscience? Because otherwise, all we end up doing is spending our time arguing with each other and nothing gets done.
Well, there's nothing to do. That's the point. So, there's nothing to do on the carbon file. Carbon dioxide is plant food. And when we have to look at the environmental degradation that this climate change myth is causing. So we talk about the Amazonian forest fires, but what nobody wants to tell you about that is they are controlled human burns to clear land, to grow corn, to turn into ethanol, to put in your car. Biofuels are one of the disasters that are a direct result of the allegiance to the anthropogenic global warming myth. Another disaster is the felling of North American forests to be chipped into pellets, to ship to Great Britain, to feed coal-fired plants that have been converted to wood pellets. So we literally have trees from North America going to Britain to burn in their so-called green plants. Another instance, we talk about solar, we talk about wind. Wind is very detrimental to birds. It's harmful to endangered species, and the ecological footprint of solar is actually quite huge, from the open pit mining in China to get the rare earth minerals. Like, we have to tell the full truth. Politicians and the media complex that backs this paint a very rosy picture, and they're not telling you the full story. That's what I'm here to do. I'm here to tell you there's no climate emergency. I'm here to tell you have children because it's the best thing you can do for your life. I'm here to tell you that the earth is resilient and it will still be here, and that carbon isn't an issue. Clean water, that's something we need to do. There is a massive ongoing natural disaster in the near Eldoro Mines, polluting the Moira River Basin, that I am surprised that nobody knows about because nobody's telling you about it. It's an old closed down mine. It is literally polluting the Moira River Basin, which feeds into Belleville, with heavy metals. Nobody's talking about cleaning that up. Except us. We're talking about targeting legitimate environmental disaster that we can actually do something about. Canada, even if you accept the carbon dioxide myth, Canada can do absolutely nothing to change it. China is bringing coal online. India is bringing coal online. They are pumping out CO2 left, right, and center. The argument that is being made is that we need to deindustrialize our civilization, basically end prosperity in the name of chasing a problem that doesn't even exist.
Does it really help your cause, though, when your leader calls a 16-year-old girl mentally unstable?
No, and that's, you know what, he has to answer for that, and he did answer for that. That is not how I would have proceeded on that. But the fact of the matter is, I think the point that he badly made is that she herself talks about that, and she's put herself out there, and she's put that out in the public domain. That was a terrible exercise of judgment. But if you step onto the world stage, and here's the point, What Greta is doing is creating fear, creating massive amounts of fear and causing children to panic and lose sleep and some to consider suicide. That is irresponsible. That's why her ideas need to be challenged.
Would you say that to the same parents that take their children out to the Fridays for the Future in Port Hope at the park to protest climate change?
Yeah, I did it yesterday. I spoke to a whole classroom because teachers and academia are not doing their due diligence in presenting both sides. At this stage, these children are being propagandized with only one set of points of view. So yeah, I bring that message everywhere I go.
So you would say that to the parents? You're
100%. I would explain to the parents the other side of the climate change debate for sure.
Okay. On that note then, I can't believe we've already got through halfway of our show, but time's flying. So we're going to take a break for some commercials. I'm talking to Frank Vaughan, candidate for the People's Party of Canada in Northumberland, Peterborough South. Please stay tuned to Consider This on Northumberland 89.7 FM, your truly local source for news. We'll be right back. Hello and welcome back. Consider This on Northumberland, and I am your host, Robert Washburn, and you're listening to Northumberland 89.7 FM. My guest today is Frank Vaughan, candidate for the People's Party of Canada, Northumberland, Peterborough South, and we are talking about his platform for the upcoming federal election on October 21st. Tell us a bit about yourself, Frank.
So I've lived in the county pretty much my entire life. Somebody could get me for a factual inaccuracy there because I started as a little kid in another place. But my evolution here, I used to be a utility contractor, and then I've done a lot of factory work. And as I was explaining before we were on air, I ended up on the farm I'm at with my wife growing garlic. That's our main thing that we do now. That's where how we're known locally. And I've been involved in various community initiatives over the years, just basically in the area of looking out for residents that might have been overlooked in official processes. And I've gotten into a little bit of political commentary in more recent times, and I just had my first son, and I'm loving that.
Very cool. Do you remember the moment where you became passionate about politics?
Oh, I've always cared. I can remember the first moment that I started caring about nonfiction, let's call it. My father bought me a book on the Second World War because I had expressed interest in it. I was maybe 6 or 7 years old. I didn't understand most of the words in that book, but I read it religiously, trying to find out more about the history. I think it covered 13 battles, 13 pinnacle battles of the war. And I can remember as I grew understanding more and more of these big words, but I've always read more nonfiction than fiction.
Let me ask you this. Would you consider yourself pro-life?
Now that's a complex one because I am neither pro-choice nor am I pro-life exclusively. I think there's an area of nuance. Now, one of the things, and I'll give you just a couple examples so that you understand where I'm coming from. In Canada, if a drunk driver hits a car and kills a pregnant mother and her unborn baby, that person's only charged with one count of murder because that fetus has absolutely no designation under the law. That's a problem for me. That's a big problem for me. I also have a problem with extreme late-term abortion of healthy babies. That's an issue for me. It's an issue for my wife. Having just gone through pregnancy and talking to her about it, like the entire experience that she went through, I was asking her questions at every single stage. And one of the questions I asked her was, and this was like more of a second to third trimester question, just in periods. I'm not trying to make a statement on the policy or anything like that. But I asked her, I'm like, so, you know, having felt this, is that baby you or is it someone else? And she said, that baby has its own personality in there. It's its own person. I keep it alive, but I feel like I'm hosting it. And that created some thought for me. So I don't want to take that choice away from people because I know if I was in a situation, my wife and I have discussed this, where she's pregnant and we get an ultrasound back and that baby's got some serious problems and it might not have the easiest of life, there's a discussion to be had there and a decision to be made that I would not want to deny anybody, but I think there's room for discussion and nuance, and I think there should be some debate at least over some amount of fetal rights.
If the Cobourg Pride Parade was inviting you to come and march in its parade, would you go?
I've been asked this before, too. I have no problem attending either a gay or straight Pride Parade. My issue with Pride, especially in the city, is it's become an event that is, it's not just about people being proudly gay. I have a lot of gay customers. I have a lot of LGBT people who follow my work. They find it repulsive, and they don't want to go anywhere near it because it's become a display of basic public news. Nudity and indecency. You have people walking down the road that have sex objects taped all over their bodies as they're naked, and there's little children running around. I have a problem with that. I have a problem with kids and sex being combined. It's a big issue for me. So if it was conducted decently and we didn't have that sort of stuff, if Cobourg had a pride parade, I'm pretty sure out here it's a rural riding, people would be respectful. I'd have no issue with that at all. I do have an issue with the public indecency that seems to be plaguing the one in Toronto.
I want to talk now, go back to talking about issues, and I want to talk now about agriculture, because your agriculture policy is pretty clear about having an open and fair, what you call an open and fair system, and it sounds like, and that doesn't sound, you actually say that you are going to phase out the supply management system. Why is that a good public policy?
Supply management is a cartel. That's what it is. And it's a failed cartel. The objective of supply management was to protect family farms. Now, first off, the one thing that people have to understand is 90% of Canadian farms are not governed by supply management. They have to fend for themselves in the free market, whether you're growing soy, corn, wheat, garlic. In my case, I compete directly with China. I often sell my garlic for 10 times the price of China. I win because I have quality. Supply management was brought in ostensibly to protect dairy, chicken producers, egg producers, and keep a stable, artificially inflated price. Now, what has happened is there were 62,000 family farms that were governed by supply management when it was brought in. That number has been whittled down to 12,000. It's actually led to centralization. And now, as a person who's been running farmers markets for years, I can't tell you how many times a family comes up to me that has just bought land in the area and they say, I want to get a small herd of dairy cattle going. I want to start selling my cheese locally. I want to start making dairy products. And I have to tell them the bad news. You can't do that because you're not allowed in this country to do that. So it's not just about the dairy board makes it about competition from outside the country, makes it about America, makes it about takeovers. But it also works the other way. It keeps small producers from getting in and marketing their products locally. That's an issue for me. When it comes to chicken, for instance, chicken is supply managed. You know how many years we've been advocating for people to be able to grow chickens? It initially started, you could have 150 birds, and they increased the number to 300. Now they have some sort of arcane program for heritage chicken or whatever it's called, artisan chicken, I think it's called. But the way it used to work is you couldn't sell your chicken to anybody. You couldn't tell anybody that you were selling chicken unless they asked you. You couldn't sell it off your farm. You couldn't market it at a farmer's market. It's not about supply safety. It's about protecting the interests of a few farms against competition from the bottom. That's an issue for me.
Okay, but if at the same time, as you argued earlier, there is the issue of food security. And we talk about our ability to, you know, we'd be exporting more. We couldn't get supplies. There are other countries that provide subsidies to farmers, United States, European Union. All these support farmers, and therefore it doesn't make it for a level playing field. And also it creates unstable pricing. I guess it's a little bit different maybe for you as a small farmer with garlic. It's a little bit different. But for these others, it's a major blow to how they do business and whether they can or cannot be competitive. How do you answer those concerns?
Nobody who has a monopoly wants to give up the monopoly. Nobody who has a guaranteed price point wants to give that up. I understand that completely. It's just common sense and it's human nature. But we know from the example of Australia, for instance, and New Zealand, there was massive public outcry about phasing out their supply management systems. They did so, and they became among the world's leading export producers of dairy products to the world, and they've been quite successful. And more close to home, so that people say, well, you're looking at Australia, that's not Canada, we have the Ontario wine industry. It used to be supply managed. It was phased out. Now we have one of the strongest export markets in wine in the world. So the idea that businesses can't retool, and we're not talking about snapping our fingers and it's gone tomorrow morning. We're talking about buying the quota back. So there will be money for the quota to be purchased back, and a five-year phase-out period gives people lots of time to adapt. Now, as far as scale, you mentioned that I'm a small farmer, and I understand that. But there are people out there farming thousands of acres, growing corn, wheat, soy, oats, other products, and they succeed on the free market. There's people out there I know personally who want supply management gone, but they're afraid to speak out for the social consequences. They farm beef, hundreds of heads of cattle. They compete in the free market, and they win. So it can be done, and it should be done, and it's also costing us, it's costing the poorest Canadians $500 a year to keep our prices up. These people are going to buy because they don't have the money. They're going to buy the cheapest products they can find anyway. They're not going to be buying free-range organic eggs because they don't have the cash for that. Why we're taxing them is something beyond me.
Your immigration policy for the party talks about substantially lowering the total number of immigrants and refugees in Canada each year from 350,000 to somewhere between 100,000 and 150,000. Why is that good policy?
So on the refugee point, we want to, it's not that we want to stop taking refugees. We have actually identified in our platform what refugees we want to take and how we do it. The way we used to do refugees in this country was they were privately sponsored and then you had accountability. We don't want public funds funding refugees. And now on the immigration file itself, Canada is the biggest net immigrator in the world in terms of per capita population. The numbers that we're talking about right now is 1% of our population every single year.
Why is that a bad thing, though?
Because it drives up housing prices in Toronto and the Fraser Valley. Half of those immigrants drive in there. Everybody's talking about housing costs in this country. But when you're allowing such demand and you're not keeping up with the supply of housing, and at the same time you have the country being flooded by foreign money buying up lands, huge swaths of Saskatchewan are gone. There's all sorts of speculation with foreign money in the country. It drives up prices so that Canadians of all backgrounds can't have affordability. There's other reasons too.
Okay, but you're tying one breath. You're saying it's about money driving up prices, and then you're also saying it's about immigration and refugees. So refugees come. Okay, let's just work with that for a second. So how do you justify that in particular directly just to affordable housing? I mean, they do lots of good things. There's all kinds of studies that have been done. I mean, there was just a study released in April that said that a 100-year arc looking at immigration in Canada for 100 years, and in all cases over that 100-year period, it's been a positive. So why is this such a bad thing if it's been shown to be such a positive thing? They make contributions in terms of business, they make contributions socially. Why is it a bad thing?
Well, we actually used the own government statistics to compile our immigration policy. And I believe the study that you're citing, I've read, comes from a pro-immigration think tank. Now, the fact of the matter is, 3/4 of the immigrants we're bringing into the country at this point are coming in through family reunification. When you want to talk about looking at immigration over the last 100 years, you're sort of changing, or you're not giving proper due to the fact that the way that we do immigration has changed massively over the last roughly 15 years. It started under Stephen Harper. This is a bipartisan issue. A lot of what we're doing now is family reunification. 3/4 of the immigrants that come in are actually costing the economy money. Our plan focuses on bringing in immigrants that meet our economic needs. So instead of having 3/4 be dependent and 1/4 being economic migrants, we want to bring in people who are strictly economic immigrants that fulfill our economic needs and strengthen Canada. And it's also, you cannot, and the reason I link these things together is you cannot have a conversation about rising home costs without addressing the fact that you're bringing in 1% and a 1% increase every single year in the population of Canada. That drives up home prices in the Fraser Valley and in the GTA because half of those immigrants land there and there's not a supply. So the unaffordability of housing is directly tied to immigration, and nobody wants to have that conversation. It's not about race. It's not about any of that stuff. It's about making sure that Canada's immigration system is sustainable and we don't break the piggy bank doing it.
Why did your party call for face-to-face interviews for immigrants?
Well, because we do have some issues in this country with cultural integration. One of the individuals that Justin Trudeau and Andrew Scheer have met with on a regular basis in Toronto is an imam, and he has a YouTube channel that everybody can go to, and you can find information from me. I won't name him here, but you can find information from me and other places about this individual, and he has advice. He has YouTube videos on how to properly beat your wife in accordance with his religious beliefs. Is that something we want in Canada? We have equality of the sexes in Canada. Is it right that we are allowing the segregation of the sexes? Like, these are things that are of concern as we have a growing population.
I don't want to get going around too big a circle, but we earlier in the last section talked about freedom of speech and how important that is to your party. How can you on one hand argue freedom of speech and then you just told me that somebody, that they put up a YouTube video that's repugnant?
Oh, it's a YouTube video about beating your wife. Okay, that's causing physical harm. I'm not sure that would qualify as free speech. I mean, what we're talking about here, he's got the speech. He's got the video out there. I'm not saying take the video down. What I am asking is, in this country that supposedly stands for equality of the sexes, do we want a cultural influence that advises the segregation of the sexes and the beating of your wife? Is that something we want to defend?
So how do we determine then, and I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I think it's horrible that somebody would do that. And I agree with you, it's repugnant. But who determines what Canadian values are? Give me some examples of what you believe are Canadian values.
Intrinsically, Canadian values as set up in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which everybody should be familiar with, I would hope, or read. The government will send you a free copy to put on your wall. But freedom of speech, equality of the sexes is a huge one. We spent so long trying to get women to be on a level playing field. Now, I'm not talking here, our party represents equality of opportunity, not equality of outcome. We reject all the virtue signaling about making sure that you have gender quotas and everything else. I think that's the opposite of equality. But we need to defend equality of the sexes. We need to defend against people who would want to restrict certain forms of speech and criticism that aren't targeting people for harm, but are saying that maybe, as I said in the example, maybe in Canada we don't want an influence growing that's advising on how to properly beat your wives. I think it's clear that that is contrary to Canadian values, and that's the sort of thing that we're talking about here. I seen a video recently of an interview that was being conducted outside a rally in Toronto, and again, I won't name the source because I'm in respect for the radio station, but the interview was being conducted by some males in the streets, and they were being asked, if your wives or your girlfriends or your sisters or your mothers or the women in your family went out and got jobs, what would you do? And they said, we would kill them for going to work. That's a problem. That's a problem that's being ignored. So that's why we're concerned about that. I don't think that's unreasonable.
The Libertarian Party, when it's run in any election at any level, has never received even 1% of the popular vote. And a lot of people associate your party with libertarian values. So, in fact, I saw a number suggesting that the highest level of support that they ever got in an election was like 0.25% of the vote. Since there are so many similarities between your parties, how well do you think you will do in this election?
Well, we're not that similar. The Libertarian Party hates our guts.
I thought they were talking to you guys about joining together. They're going to vote on it.
Well, they were going to talk about it, but it didn't happen. I would encourage people to go to the Libertarian Party leader's page and read some of his criticisms of our party. It's very clear that we're not libertarians. We believe in the necessity of government. We are not looking to get rid of universal health care. These are points. There's so many others. We don't want open borders. That's another one the libertarians hammer us on. We have some libertarian values, but we are not libertarian. We have some liberal values. We have conservative values. If you read the platform, you'll find out that we have literally nothing in common with the Libertarian Party.
All right, then, still doesn't change my question. How do you think you're going to do in the election?
I think we're going to do just fine. You'll be surprised.
What's your expectation for this riding?
Well, I'm not sure about this riding because the thing that I keep hearing the most is liberals are telling me that they would love to vote for me, but they're afraid Scheer will get in. And I hear conservatives saying they're afraid to vote for me. They want to vote for me, but they're afraid to vote for me because Trudeau will get back in.
Okay, so how do you respond to that? Because that was my
question. Oh, it's very easy. It's a misnomer. Both parties engage in this rhetoric because it's easy. It's a very simple way to pave over complex facts. As I said at the beginning of this interview, we draw support from all parties. There is no vote split. And so we did a study, and it showed that of the people who voted in 2015, half of our support comes from the Conservatives, and half of our support comes from everybody else. That's of those who voted. But of our total support, 27% didn't vote at all. And I can tell you that personally. People who did not vote in 2015 are coming out to vote for the PPC because they feel like they finally got something that they can stand with. So there is no vote split. And here's the thing, just one last point on this. We are the only European-style democracy in the history of this planet who thinks that we have to have a two-party state. It's ridiculous. All other democracies that are set up like ours have 20, 30 parties, and they have to, and they're healthier for it. If you don't vote for your values, if you're constantly voting strategically, we will not increase choice. And if you don't like the PPC, don't vote for it. I completely understand. Don't vote for me. But if you don't like the other guys, heck, start your own party. I'll help you do it. Because we need more choice in this country, not less.
That sounds really good, but when you go into that ballot box with the first-past-the-post system, aren't you just throwing away your vote?
Well, that's the argument, but it's a misnomer. That
but
thinking,
how's it a misnomer? That's the system.
It's the system, but that thinking is what has led this country into disaster for 50 years under both parties. We have a spiraling national debt. We have a huge deficit. We're not fixing problems. We have parties drawing closer and closer and closer on the spectrum, and a lot of them are just not willing to have difficult conversations. It should be obvious from this interview that I'm willing to have the difficult conversations. I'm willing to try and tell you the truth. That's the number one thing I hear from the debate feedbacks. The debates that I'm invited to, if there's any other debates out there, please invite me, is that I'm willing to say things that they've never heard before, and I'm willing to answer questions directly. That's the other thing. Politicians don't answer questions directly. They speak in platitudes. You might have learned now that I don't do that.
Would you support proportional representation?
I think it's one option that I would be willing to look at. One of my personal passions is electoral reform. Proportional representation is one way to do it. But I think to really address the problems with this country doesn't come from first past the post in the parliament. We need an elected Senate. We can elect our governor generals. We can do the governor general thing quicker than we can do the Senate. But if Pierre Trudeau can repatriate the Constitution when he wasn't that popular a leader, that's one of the big myths in this country, is that he was universally popular. He wasn't. He managed to repatriate the Constitution and set this country up in 82 with some flaws. I believe Canadians are mature enough that we could have a conversation about true electoral reform.
How many seats do you think you'll win on election night across the country?
Well, I'm not going to speculate on that because the number one reason, you haven't seen Max in a national debate yet. That's going to happen on Monday. And you're going to see him in the French language debate on the 10th. I believe it's the 10th. I might have my date wrong.
Wasn't that just this past week?
No.
I thought it was earlier this week.
I thought it was later. Language. Well, anyway, the English one's on Monday.
Yep.
No, that was a private debate. This is the actual official Elections Canada one that David Johnson oversees.
Fine.
It's going to change the metric. We are seeing our numbers come up. And the other thing, too, is we're a new party. And I understand that we've had issues with polling companies actually putting us into the polls as an option. We've complained to Angus Reid, for instance, and Angus Reid acknowledged that he was leaving us out, and he changed it. So I applaud Angus Reid for that. We're still excluded from a lot of the polling data, and we are a new party. We're the fastest growing party in Canadian history. We have well over 300 candidates all across this country. No other party's ever done that.
Well, when you're talking to each other, though, I mean, there must be some communications. Does anybody say, look, I think I've got a chance, or hey, I think I'm going to make a breakthrough here?
We do have strength in particular areas in this country. That is for sure. Now, I'm not going to speculate on how it's going to work out, but I know we have a particularly strong candidate in Manitoba in Stephen Fletcher, for instance. We have particularly strong candidates in Alberta that are nipping at the Conservative Party bud. We have Salim Mansour down in London, who is a very popular professor, very widely respected, who was kicked out of the Conservative Party simply for expressing his opinion. Actually, he didn't even express anything. They just thought he was too dangerous, even though he's a widely acclaimed Canadian. We have Max Bernier in Bose. He's gonna take that riding hard. The Conservatives are going to spend every dollar they can, and they're not going to win. So we're going to have representation.
Frank, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to campaign to talk to me today. I appreciate it immensely.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, that's it. I'm all out of candidates. And time is running out. Advance polls will be open starting next Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And the actual election day is October 21st, so make sure to get out and vote. You may also want to tune in to Northumberland 89.7 FM on election night. I will be hosting our results of coverage that evening. We will have an exciting panel of experts, and we'll be, have reporters in the field to give you the latest results and insightful comments as things unfold. So I hope you'll join us. It should be great listening. Next week, I will return to my usual fare with some really interesting interviews about vaping and another about a new support group for cancer patients. I hope you'll tune in. If you have any comments, questions, rants, or raves about this show, please email me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can go to my Facebook page, Consider This. Or if you're on Twitter, you can message me at rwash. I will read out a selection of comments on next week's show. If you'd like to listen to this or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you'll find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your busy day to listen in. And I hope over the next week you will continue to consider this, Northumberland.